Mom, Matthew. It was his assistance and contribution that's always backing us and pushing us forward. And may God bestow his blessings to the pure soul of the late Imam Khomeini, who has opened up this way. And that's the end of the speech.
Live coverage of the speech made by leader of the Islamic.
Dear listeners, what you heard was leader of Islamic Revolution Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei speaking on the anniversary of the People of Qom's uprising against the oppressive Pahlavi regime. This anniversary is held every year in the presence of thousands of people from Qom in the Hosseiniyah of Imam Khomeini, but this year it was in the form of a televised broadcast without other people being present due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Dear listeners, many thanks for being with us. Please stay with IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. What you just heard was our special coverage. We now return to our normal course of programs.
Listen to verse 255 of chapter Baqarah, recited by Mr. Ali Askar Burumand.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Allahu la ilaha illa
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Allah is He, besides whom there is no God. the ever-living, the self-subsisting, by whom all subsist. Slumber does not overtake him, nor sleep. Whatever is in the heavens, and whatever is in the earth, is his. Who is he that can intercede with him, but by his permission? He knows what is before them and what is behind them, and they cannot comprehend anything out of his knowledge except what he pleases. His knowledge extends over the heavens and the earth, and the preservation of them both tires him not, and he is the Most High, the Great.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
U.S. President Donald Trump effectively concedes election defeat amid calls for his impeachment and a wave of resignations following the storming of Congress by his supporters. Activists condemn what they see as a disparate U.S. police response to black anti-racism protesters and white pro-Trump demonstrators. Also ahead, the World Health Organization says the fast spread of a more contagious variant of the novel coronavirus across Europe is alarming. Welcome to World News. We're live from our headquarters in the Iranian capital, Tehran. It's good to have you with us. Our top story this hour, a U.S. Capitol police officer has died of injuries he sustained during the storming of Congress by supporters of President Donald Trump. The officer, identified as Brian Sicknick, is the fifth person to die since Wednesday. The riots saw swarms of pro-Trump protesters surge into the U.S. Congress compound and force the evacuation of lawmakers. The violence broke out as Congress was meeting to certify Joe Biden's victory in the November presidential election. Four other people died as the protesters occupied the Capitol. Police in Washington, D.C. said more than 50 officers were injured during the unrest, some of them seriously. The U.S. president has announced that he is now focusing on a peaceful transition of power a day after Congress certified Joe Biden's victory in the 2020 presidential election.
I continue to strongly believe that we must reform our election laws to verify the identity and eligibility of all voters, and to ensure faith and confidence in all future elections. Now Congress has certified the results. A new administration will be inaugurated on January 20th. My focus now turns to ensuring a smooth, orderly, and seamless transition of power. This moment calls for healing and reconciliation.
Donald Trump also condemned Wednesday's attack on the U.S. Capitol, saying rioters had defiled the seat of American democracy. He added that demonstrators who infiltrated Congress do not represent the country, and those who broke the law will pay. The statement is viewed as a stark reversal for Trump, who had himself called the rally and kept insisting that he lost the race due to widespread fraud. The new U.S. administration is due to take charge on January the 20th. Mark Weber is the director of the U.S.-based Institute for Historical Review. I spoke to him earlier, and he explained why Trump did a U-turn and recognized the outcome of the November presidential vote.
The reality is now so obvious to even Donald Trump that the new administration will be coming into office in 13 days. Even Donald Trump's accepting that. The main motive for Donald Trump throughout his career and his lifetime has been that he doesn't want to be appear to be a loser. But the stunning, amazing events of yesterday and today are, I think, an entirely fitting conclusion of a four-year calamitous, contentious administration by this man that now most of the world and millions of Americans are looking forward to seeing behind us in 13 days. All his advisors, everyone, his own vice president, members of his administration, I'm sure his family, his inner circle, are all telling him that he has to wake up and just accept the obvious reality. The law has been followed. The results are in. All the efforts by the Trump administration to overturn the election results have failed. He has to accept this reality. To do anything else would just be add tragedy to the already farcical situation that everybody is seeing.
Meanwhile, top U.S. Democrats are calling for the removal of President Trump from office a day after his supporters laid siege to the Capitol building.
In calling for this seditious act, the president has committed an unspeakable assault on our nation and our people.
Nancy Pelosi branded Trump a very dangerous person, describing his removal as an emergency of the highest magnitude. Democratic leader, Chuck Schumer, said yesterday's events would not have happened without Trump in the White House. The two Democratic leaders have urged Vice President Mike Pence to invoke the 25th Amendment, which can unseat a president if he's deemed unfit for office. Reports, however, indicate that the vice president opposes the idea. Democrats, including the House Judiciary Chairman Gerald Nadler, are calling for bringing impeachment charges against Trump as the last resort. Political commentator Vladimir Goldstein says a possible impeachment of Donald Trump can further polarize the American society.
If Democrats will escalate it, it will basically, they are planting the seeds of further discord. They are sowing the seeds of further kind of strife, and I don't think it's going to be wise. You know, of course, if they're in immediate interest, it distracts attention from Democrats' own failures. It points, you know, paints Trump as a very nasty, bad guy. So it's like, you know, they like to use him as a scapegoat, but I don't think it's a wise decision. They should do their best to avoid it. It's not going to be a wise politics. Of course, what we can say is that this is all posturing, all kind of a farce, all theater. And you know, now, of course, everybody's playing some kind of a role. Some Democrats think that the more aggressive they will act or say things, you know, they're preparing something for the future. Some Republicans are jumping the ship and more or less running away from the governor. While everybody basically should sort of make the transition smooth and work on Trump, prevent him, of course, from doing something stupid.
Activists have criticized the United States law enforcement for applying what they see as racist double standards towards black and white protesters.
When black people protest for our lives, we are all too often met by National Guard troops or police equipped with assault rifles, shields, tear gas, and battle helmets. When white people attempt a coup, they are met by an underwhelming number of law enforcement personnel who act powerless to intervene, going so far as to pose for selfies with terrorists.
The Black Lives Matter movement made the criticism after President Trump's supporters breached Capitol Hill on Wednesday. Some of them entered the building as lawmakers were at a meeting to certify President-elect Joe Biden. He has also condemned police's discriminatory measures, calling them unacceptable. Vice President-elect Kamala Harris has joined the chorus of criticism too. She said the U.S. justice system does not equally apply to white and black people and called for reforming it. Alexander Azadegan is an academic and political analyst and joins us now. Professor, welcome. Do you agree? Has there been a double standard between the treatment of U.S. security forces towards Trump supporters on one side and their treatment of Black Lives Matter protesters on the other side?
Yes, that's an excellent question. Hi, Bassam. It's good to be with you and our audience. Absolutely. The premise of that question is 100% correct. Trump was what Black people have been warning us about for the past 400 years, but unfortunately, he's like a malignant virus that won't go away easily until we lock him up. When you have John Brennan, former head of the CIA, stating Trump will leave his fate to our judicial system, his infamy to history, and his legacy to a trash heap. This is a former CIA director. It's a heavyweight individual. Last time I heard, I was following our news here yesterday, around exactly 24 hours ago, only 13 people got arrested. Can you imagine if there are Black Lives Matter protesters or social justice warriors, protesters in these, if they committed what these people, these insurrectionists committed, they would have been shot, they would have been gassed, and it would have taken right in front of the camera and the law, so-called law enforcement officers would have gotten away with it. And it's very interesting, Weston, because as I was watching and following the coverage here, into the deep of the night, where the news released pictures of what these savages did inside senators' and congressmen's offices. These pictures were available, but they were not showing it to the rest of America, and this is the so-called liberal media, until everybody was asleep and we realized the extent of the damage. The fact that they were just allowed to come in with their flags, Trump is the first president that has two flags, a red flag and a blue flag. They were just like a horde of sheep that were coming in and the security breach, and there were not enough officers to enforce the law. They knew this date, January 6th, or was it 7th? January 6th. They knew this was a sensitive day. They knew that was the date Congress was going to certify the Electoral College votes, and yet we didn't see adequate coverage of this.
Indeed.
Personally, go ahead.
Alexander, I'll let you back in. There's a lot of questions being raised as to how, as you say, Trump supporters so easily stormed the Congress. You're saying you find something odd as to that as well. Mitch McConnell's Congress office was stormed in June 2017 by disability rights activists. These guys are disabled, protesting cuts to Medicaid. Now, 60 of them, many with wheelchairs, arrested and removed by force by police, even dragging them from their chairs to the exit doors.
I remember that despicable incident, how these poor people were treated. Meanwhile, these insurrectionists, we just should call them terrorists. I hate when we call them domestic terrorists. When we put the word domestic in front of terrorists, what do we think of? Domestic industry, domestic auto sector, domesticated cats. These were actual terrorists who later, many of them said, next time we're going to show up in rifles. They should be taken seriously. There was a security breach. Perhaps some of the people there, security guards, were biased toward these people. The treatment of so-called white protesters is completely different than what we do with Black protesters. And I'm afraid the Republican Party has really degenerated into an openly white supremacist party. And I'm a conservative telling you this. When you have such polarizing rhetoric from the White House, from Donald Trump, these fringe ideas, the disinformation becomes the order of the day, then you have low information voters become prone to conspiracy theories. I tell my students, the ones that are Black, that when it comes to police brutality and outright murder, my advice to them is don't get into a conversation, definitely not into an argument with these gung-ho, confrontational, agitated, and aggravated police officers. These type of cops are ready and trained and sometimes trigger-happy to shoot and kill you. And getting into a confrontive conversation with these people is a guarantee that you're going to end up getting murdered. So you have to be at protests here, some of us who attended the protests, to realize the actual double standard of what has been happening in America. And so this is not enough. I'll wrap it up in a few seconds. Westham, it's not enough for the president to get on TV after so many weeks and finally admit defeat and sort of, which he does that in order to create more publicity for his show when he gets out on Newsmax or some of these idiotic ultra-right-wing so-called news channels. It's not enough. He incited a riot. That is a federal crime. He should go to prison, and the Democrats should actually develop some backbone to prosecute him after he gets out of office, because he's not going to stop. He's going to keep on creating division and think he's going to be relevant. And guess what? The news in this country is going to cover him. Before he got elected, the news coverage he got was around $2 billion. I repeat, $2 billion of free advertisement, because it was controversial. And when they brought him on TV, people were watching. So the tactics and the strategies have to change in dealing with this narcissistic psychopath.
Okay, Professor, thank you very much indeed for your thoughts and your contribution there. Alexander Azadegan, academic and political analyst, joining us out of Irvine. Staying in the U.S., which has marked its deadliest day of the COVID-19 pandemic with nearly 4,000 fatalities, according to data from Johns Hopkins University, the record number of deaths has brought the total toll to nearly 365,000. The U.S. also recorded more than 265,000 new coronavirus infections. The overall number of people infected with the virus has topped 21.5 million. The United States is the world's worst hit country by the pandemic in terms of infections and fatalities. Meanwhile, COVID-19 deaths in Brazil have surpassed the grim milestone of 200,000, the second highest in the world, as the South American nation prepares to begin its vaccination program. The Brazilian Health Ministry also reported a record number of nearly 88,000 new cases. This takes the total confirmed cases of the infection in the country to nearly 8 million. The latest figures come following the Health Ministry's announcement that the country is ready to begin vaccinating its population against COVID-19 this month. The World Health Organization says Europe needs to do more to deal with an alarming situation brought by a new COVID variant. The WHO's European branch has called on everyone to follow rules on social distancing, mask wearing, and staying at home. Otherwise, the organization warned there will be an increased impact on the already stressed health systems. The WHO says the new coronavirus variant has already been detected in 22 European countries. Many states there have begun vaccination programs and imposed strict lockdown measures to battle COVID. The new strain surfaced in the UK and is more transmissible because of that. Infections have increased rapidly in Europe, already a hard-hit region by the pandemic. The UN says the majority of vulnerable people in refugee camps across the globe have turned to negative coping mechanisms to survive during the COVID-19 pandemic. Livelihoods have been wiped out, and the UN says it needs hundreds of millions of dollars to bring the people back from the brink. Banker Rahimi has more details in the following reports.
For refugees in reception camps in Greece, it has been a year of fires, double displacement, and now COVID-19. With rolling lockdowns enforced since March, along with restrictions that have only served to make unbearable living conditions even worse. In response to this, independent groups have sprung up and are trying to make a difference. Yellow Days is one of them. Empowering forced migrants and changing the narrative surrounding their circumstances lies at the heart of everything they do.
We're there to provide a platform. And what we do is unite. We use food, music and art, which are the tools that no matter where you're coming from or where you're going, we all have in common. So by providing a safe space, providing a safe platform where everyone can just be themselves, people can celebrate who they are.
The friendships forged during Yellow Days festivals have lasted, and although COVID-19 prevented them from getting together in 2020, the team is still busy making magic happen online.
We have this, you know, distortion and idea of feeling that the refugee community has poor people, they're waiting to be helped, they're just depressed and waiting for answers, and it's far from the reality that I have experienced especially with all my forced migrant friends. They're people that are active. They're people with loads of skill, power, and talent. And all that we do at the Yellow Days is bring all those people together.
Yellow Days is run by a core group of 8 women, which members say is one of its most important aspects. One of the primary goals of groups like this is creating a model for a more sustainable future, not only for forced migrants and minorities, but the entire human race. The International Rescue Committee says depression, post-traumatic stress disorder, and self-harm that are the byproducts of hopelessness and despair have spiked amid COVID-19 restrictions. With the majority of asylum applications on pause, there's no means of escape, and during COVID-19, self-isolating often means being locked in a shipping container with many others.
More than half of those surveyed said that COVID has caused them depression, worry, anxiety, and loneliness.
Every year, tens of thousands of refugees reach Greek shores. The media has aided the dehumanization of asylum seekers by reducing them to just that, a statistic. But there are still those fighting for stories to be told and lives celebrated. Bianca Rahimi, London.
And that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour, but don't go away.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
On Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers, whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change, and that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
The Epic of Eight-Year Holy Defense.
In the name of God, Salam, and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, we have said several times that the Iraqi dictator Saddam's main goal of initiating the eight-year war and invading Iran was to overthrow the Islamic Republic system. He pursued other goals too, but he and his masters in Washington, Moscow, Tel Aviv, and Europe didn't reach any of their goals. In this episode, we are going to dwell upon the role of national cooperation and empathy during the 8 years of war, which resulted in the frustration of the enemies and victory of the Iranian people. Stay tuned, please. When the Iranian people, alongside military forces, entered the battlefield, the armed forces gained a stronger morale for fighting and repelling the aggressive enemy. The armed forces trusted the people and vice versa. This trust turned into a real belief and played a very significant role in the final triumph of the Islamic Republic of Iran in the imposed war. As the Basij volunteer forces participated in the war, people from all walks of life and from various occupations felt their responsibility to take part in the war. Most of the Basij forces were young people from different specialties. Thus, the war theater was the arena for manifestation of different talents. In view of this, from among these volunteer forces, great commanders emerged like martyr Hassan Bagheri, who had gone to the front as a journalist but turned into a genius in combat operations. Many of the scientific and technological Gordian knots of the war were opened by these very popular forces. Presently, too, Iran owes many of its great achievements and progresses to these people. If we look at the war from this aspect, we should say that many of the senior commanders of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps and the army who played a determining role in the war were trained in the cultural ground of the Holy Defense. Although over 250,000 of the best youth of Iran were martyred in the war, the future of the country has been guaranteed by these very motivated people. We'll be right back. The participation of Basiji forces in the administration of cities and villages during the war solved many problems for the government. In fact, the Basiji organization entered the arena of problems and made its utmost effort to remove obstacles on the way of government and the people. The most outstanding feature of the Basiji has always been its self-sacrifice and readiness for working whenever need arises. The Basiji forces didn't wait to become strong to fight. They fought to become strong. The manpower that emerged in the war firmly believed in Imam Khomeini's famous phrase, "We can." The Iranian combatants created such values during the war that have rarely been seen in the wars in the world. They would compete for doing the hardest jobs. The Basiji forces, especially the youth, had fought with their carnal and mean desires first. The battlefronts were the places of self-building and moral expurgation. The combatants would never backbite or tell a lie. They refrained from having grudges against each other. They would never calumniate one another. They would avoid show-off, that is, they would do everything for God's sake and not for becoming famous or being praised by others. The higher a combatant was in military rank, the humbler he would become. In view of this, many times the commanders would wake up at night to polish the boots of their forces or wash their clothes while they were asleep. The battlefronts were the places of spirituality and hope in God. When one or some of the fellow combatants were martyred, others would try to keep the morale of the forces high and fresh. There were innumerable cultural values in the eight-year holy defense. The war caused the spirit of not fearing of death prevail among people. Many people could see manifestation of the ayahs of the Noble Quran. They could see that the blood of martyrs was enlivening and each martyr could revive dead souls among people to continue his path. Martyrdom seeking and self-sacrifice had become the prevalent culture of the majority of the people. People highly esteemed their combatants, and martyrdom was considered as an eternal dignity. People really believed in the Quranic ayah, which reads, "And do not suppose those who have been killed in the way of Allah as dead. Rather, they are living, receiving sustenance with their Lord." According to Imam Khomeini, this ayah does not point to the life after this world, as all creatures will have some sort of life in the other world. Rather, it says that martyrs enjoy living with their Lord and enter Allah's banquet. In short, the holy defense was a unique period in which all divine values and moralities materialized and were palpably present in the society.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.
onto our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Ministry.
...2020 is an inflection point. Countless articles, reports, and feature stories have been produced about the unprecedented nature of the year. Top headlines made references to the global pandemic and the ongoing financial crisis. If West Asia were a company, it would have filed for bankruptcy this December, declaring its inability to shoulder losses any further. But unfortunately, it is not a company that can liquidate itself out of existence, but rather a home of millions who have no choice but to carry on with their lives against all odds, putting up with endless wars, corruption, and COVID-19. Hosting some of the oldest inhabited cities in the world, the region today is nothing but a giant museum where people can come to visit the past, but catch no glimpse whatsoever of the future due to constant Western aggression and intervention. The Western war on Syria has come to a closure, but the country is far from being back on its feet as U.S. sanctions ravage the country's economy. Millions of refugees remain displaced both at home and throughout the neighborhood, while entire cities and towns are still in rubble, pounding to dust during the 10-year global war on the sovereign nation. Lebanon is no better shape. The country's cash-strapped economy plunged into freefall in late 2019, resulting in meltdown of its once thriving banking and tourism sectors. The savings of ordinary Lebanese have been reduced to nothing but a number on their checkbooks, with banks unable to restore people's deposits. Then came the port explosion of August 4, 2020, destroying Beirut and killing over 200 people. 4 months later, accountability has yet to be achieved, and none of the wrongdoers have been brought to justice. Iraq, too, was expecting better days ahead with the installing of a new prime minister in mid-2020. Mustafa al-Kadhimi was hailed as a breath of fresh air, promising to address economic woes. However, the continuous American intervention in the country, alongside with the twin shock of COVID-19 and the collapse in global oil prices, led to the miserable condition today. The most acute escalation of all in 2020, though, was the U.S.'s assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, prompting unending tension that might just keep moving to the front of the queue in terms of a key driver for 2021. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. ...2,750 tons of ammonia confiscated ammonia nitrate were hoarded between the years of 2013 and 2014 at Beirut's port number 12.
Yeah.
They were impacted with a spark of fire. This is the official scenario, produced what possibly is the largest chemical explosion after Nagasaki. Mm-hmm. Who is to blame, and why are the Persian Gulf media outlets repeating the word Hezbollah every time they want to talk about the Beirut explosion?
Well, with regards to storing these risky materials, I believe that it was out of neglect, negligence, and of course corruption. Because it seems that officials in the state, each was trying to sell this material to one side or another, favored to him. So that's one factor which kept this risky material in the port. of course, ill conditions, but there could be also a possibility of a perpetrator who ignited the fire, especially that the port is not well secured and it could be easily infiltrated from outside.
You mean anyone could have walked in?
There is a possibility, yes.
Mm-hmm.
So, especially with the internet division in Lebanon and with people divided in their loyalties and their affiliations.
Mm-hmm.
So, this is a possibility. Why the Gulf media is trying to blame Hezbollah? Because I believe that it's not only the Gulf media, but it's also Western media
mm-hmm.
that is trying to lay the blame on Hezbollah, because the West mainly and its Lebanese allies are trying to capitalize on the event in order to call for international mandate over the port
mm-hmm.
and the airport, and under the claim of neutrality on one hand, and on corruption of any local investigative team that could handle the case, that they don't have trust in any local team. So I believe that they are trying to capitalize on this in order to put the port and the airport under international, let's say, control. And it was also coupled by attempts to shift the role of the UNIFIL in Lebanon in order to give it prerogatives of acting and not as a peacekeeping force, but rather as an occupying force that
mm-hmm.
would protect the borders on behalf of the Israeli entity.
The world is really not in shock by the UAE's betrayal of the Palestinian cause by inking this so-called peace agreement with Israel. However, coming out like this only opens doors to more Arab states to do exactly the same. What do you think will, which actually state do you think will be next to betray Palestine?
First of all, thank you for having me. And second, I wouldn't call it betrayal, because the word betrayal itself, it gives the assumption that the Emirates have had an active role in the struggle beside the Palestinians or against Israel,
mm-hmm.
or have a deep solidarity. So I'm very skeptical using the word betrayal. But having said that, and having seen the path that the United Arab Emirates have taken in the last few years, we know for the fact that the Emirates have been normalizing sport normalization, intellectual normalization, even space normalization in terms of allowing Israeli jets, for example, or even allowing Israeli citizens to have a transit in the Abu Dhabi and Dubai. I think we would have either one Bahrain. One thing, or Oman, which Oman has a long history of normalization with Israel, but it seems that the Bahrain is on the top list of these. Of course, we wouldn't rule Sudan, a new regime, and his appetite to normalize with Israel. But let me stress that Israel is usually normalized with authoritarian and autocratic regimes.
Mm-hmm.
So if we look at who are the states that normalize with Israel, I mean states that's not in the surrounding historic Palestine,
mm-hmm.
We would say that the Emirates, I mean, we have high level of authoritarianism there. They are, of course, they have high quality of life,
mm-hmm.
but they don't have freedom of speech. I mean, that the only way that the Emirati could express, for example, their opinion is to stay silent, as many Western journalists have witnessed in the Emirate, as well as on online by just writing emojis and not a single word. So to sum this, I think that we will witness a country that have been normalizing with Israel and sport normalization, political normalization and such as Bahrain. I mean, we need to measure what the Emirates did, and then we will find out who is the next.
A model of defiance against oppression and injustice, a woman of patience and of endurance. There was no act of worship greater than continuing the rising of her brother, delivering fiery sermons in Kufa, in Syria, in Yazid's own majlis. How do you think this role taken by Hazrat Zainab alayhi salam served Islam?
I think first of all, I'd like to extend condolences on Ashura to all of the people watching and to yourselves. But I think the entire epic of Ashura required a second component. It's not just one component that makes the victory. You need to have the component of Imam al-Hussein and the actual stance within Karbala, but also you need Sayyid Zainab and the second Zainabi revolution that actually got the message that was delivered, that was learnt or should have been learnt in Karbala to the wider population and even to us. If Sayyid Zainab had not made the speeches and had the resolve and the strength that she did have, then today you and me probably wouldn't be having this discussion, because Karbala would have just been a blip in history. Sayyid Zainab made sure that Karbala was never forgotten, and that the sacrifice of the 72 was always something that was understood by people, that drives people. And of course we know in Lebanon, the idea of Sayyid Zainab and the idea of Imam al-Hussein is one of the key ingredients that resulted in the 2000 ejection of the Zionists from South Lebanon. And of course, it's also one of the things that helped with the 2006 victory. But also with Iran and the Islamic Revolution and our brothers and sisters in Yemen, in Syria, everywhere, it is this fire of Karbala that has been nurtured and that has been strengthened by the lessons of Sayyid Zainab, and by the fact that she never once, in the worst of situations, when her two children were killed, instead of falling down and weeping and everything, she went down into prostration and said, "Rabbana taqabbal minna hadha qurban," that, "Oh God, accept from us this sacrifice." Mm-hmm. The same thing when she saw the body of Imam al-Hussein with the head severed and everything on Ashura, she didn't break down. Rather, she resigned herself, the same way Imam Hussein and all of these companions and the family had resigned themselves to the fact that this is something we have to do, and this life is temporary. And so they said, "Oh Allah, please accept this service from us."
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
How did Yemen become the Karbala of our time? To discuss this issue with us from Sydney is Jay Therapel, who is a member of the Yemen Solidarity Council. Thank you very much, Jay, for being with us. Now, what motivated Imam Hussein alayhi salam to leave for Karbala was to make sure that the rule over the nation does not fall in the hands of the likes of Yazid. Now, al-Hussein went out announcing his revolution, which will remain obviously immortal over time, but so that successive generations will be able to draw lessons from the revolution by confronting injustice. How do you see this in Yemen today in comparison to the revolution of Karbala?
Well, this comparison is made by the Ansarullah movement themselves because there are so many parallels between what they've endured since the victory of their revolution in September 2014 and the events leading up to Karbala. Firstly, Imam al-Hussein never took up arms against Yazid. Rather, it was Yazid that took up arms against Hussein and the Ahlul Bayt, culminating in the massacre at Karbala. Similarly, Ansarullah never took up arms against the former Yemeni government. Instead, it was that government under the former president, Ali Abdullah Saleh, that took up arms against Ansarullah. Even U.S. think tanks like the RAND Corporation admit that Ansarullah were acting within the boundaries of the laws and constitution, and that the only reason Saleh responded to this political challenge with brute military force in 2004 is because he was being pressured to do so by the U.S. and Saudi Arabia. They used military force to combat a political ideology because they knew the Ansarullah movement resonates with millions of Yemenis who believe their country has been kept artificially poor and reduced to a reserve army of cheap labor for the Saudi economy. Secondly, on the day of Ashura, the Ansarullah movement also remembers its own martyrs, beginning with the founder of Ansarullah, Sayyid Hussein al-Houthi, who was brutally murdered along with his family members and followers by the Saleh regime. Finally, in the words of Imam Ali, be like the flower that gives its fragrance to even the hand that crushes it. Today, the same Yemeni army that was sent to crush Ansarullah are now fighting shoulder to shoulder with them in defense of their nation.
Prominent Iranian nuclear physicist Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh's name was mentioned multiple times in the presentation in 2008 by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, during which he repeated baseless claims about the Iranian nuclear program. Now, such blatant evidence against the Zionist regime of Israel compels the UNSC and the so-called international community, if you will, to condemn this act of terrorism. Do you think that this might actually become a possibility?
Iran doesn't have any expectations. Condemnations really don't do much good when a crime has been carried out. The only way to really make the aggressor refrain from committing similar crimes again is for them to suffer the consequences.
Mm-hmm.
But the European Union, the British, Western governments, none of them condemned it. The European Union called it a criminal act, but there was no condemnation, and there will be repercussions. If you recall, when the British regime claimed that Russian double agent was attacked in England or poisoned in England, even though he didn't die, they made this a huge issue. And the whole of the EU, the United States, Canada, felt 150 Russian diplomats. Result. In the case of Iran, there's condemnation. And in addition to that, there's no force behind the statements themselves. So Iran is forced with the initiative. Iran will definitely retaliate. But also Iran will reduce its commitments to the nuclear deal as well as the conflict with the JCPOA. It retaliates against the regime for the attack. And Iran's reduced commitment to cooperation will be a response to Iran's attack and the difference.
Well, Dr. Mirindi, leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has called on Iranian experts to preserve the scientific and technical legacy of the nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh and ordered the punishment of his assassins. We all remember the retaliation for the assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, which shook the American presence in Iraq. What are the prospects of something similar, maybe as a retaliation for Israel, as well as maybe the military presence of the U.S. in the region?
Well, the response to the murder of General Soleimani by the Americans was not the final response. It was a response.
Mm-hmm.
The leader said that that was only one step So we still have score to settle. With regards to General Fakhrizadeh, I think the response will be the same. It will be comprised of different components. One component will be lethal, and another component will be a loss of access to Iran's nuclear program and an increased speed in the development of that program.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Mohammad Mirandi, professor at Tehran University, for talking to us about the prospects of retaliation of what Iran will be possibly be doing against the assassins of Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. Thank you for being with us. Now, please stay tuned. We'll talk in the next segment about how the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad is trying to impose its views on the Iraqi government and nation. Well, Leif, Biden must truly understand that Iraq today is different from the Iraq that he knew, especially the one where he decided to present a platform or a plan in the U.S. to divide the country into three semi-autonomous regions. America itself is at a defining moment in Iraq, controlling no territory or very specific territory, having no influence or unable even to intervene in political decision-making process. They are regularly being threatened by the popular mobilization units for a confrontation, especially in the event that the U.S. does not actually abide by the withdrawal timetable set by the Iraqi parliament for them to leave the country. How do you see the Iraqi factions reacting to Biden's plan if he really has it in mind to be implemented in Iraq?
Well, the last time the United States attempted to do that with the referendum in Iraq, Kurdistan province, we saw the response, the immediate response from the government of Iraq, from the factions in Iraq, and even from the government of Iran and Turkey. Within hours of that referendum, all the entrances and exits to Kurdistan were, you know, taken over by Iraqi army and the Iranian army, and that ended it, that possibility of separation. So the West can dream as much as they want of fracturing Arab societies and countries further, but that plan is gone, long gone. The power to do so that may have existed around World War I, even maybe after the end of the Soviet Union, is gone now. The United States has burnt all its cards, all its games have been played out and didn't work out, and everybody knows these plots and plans by heart. Everybody has memorized what the United States is trying to do, and it's not going to work out.
So you think Biden might actually have another option on the table here?
Well, the option that we see the United States in general, whether it's Biden or Trump in power, is confrontation with Iran. They've tried to fracture the Iraqi society since the 1990s, mm-hmm. and it didn't work out. They tried invading, defeating Hezbollah in Lebanon, and it didn't work out. They tried invading and fracturing Syria, and it didn't work out. So now the only thing that they have in front of them is to have a confrontation with Iran, which is also not going to work out.
This is what I want to talk about, the legacy, especially as you will be in part, as I mentioned, a member of parliament representing Hezbollah, the Lebanese resistance, the Lebanese Islamic resistance. How do you think the legacy of the likes of a warrior like Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani has affected the performance of your local Lebanese resistance?
You're totally right. Actually, when you see someone who has this self-denial, he is altruist. He sacrifices himself. He works day and night. He never recognized anything of the halal pleasures of life. He is away from his family. He's away from everything, only to help any oppressed. You know, we know very well, and we all remember the Mount of Sinjar, where Yazidis actually they were downtrodden and they were mutilated, they were killed, they were cleansed by Daesh. Who helped them? The Kurds as well in Iraq. All those who shouted for help, the Soleimani ears were there, the Iranian ears, the Iranian ears of the Islamic Republic of Iran, of this revolution, of the oppressed was there to help people everywhere in the world. We all remember here in Lebanon, we remember Bosnia and Herzegovina when the Iranians helped there. We remember Palestine, we remember everywhere. That's why the kind of legacy and heritage, even if we are working now in the parliament, some may be working like yourself or others in the media front, in the social media, all kinds of media. Some people would work, and now as they work in the medical field with this now coronavirus, and at certain times all those who are wounded or mutilated by the Israeli aggressions, raids, whatever, we should excel, because Qasem Soleimani has set an exemplary model, a model of sacrifice for everyone who would work in every kind of field in order to excel. And I would suggest, really, we have to have this kind of Soleimani icon, like a medal for everyone who excels in his field. We should, not the Islamic Republic of Iran. We are those who benefited from his blood, from his sacrifices, more than anyone else. He embodies and dramatizes, and he gives an example about the Islamic Revolution, the Islamic Republic. But we, the people of all of this axis of the resistance, people of the humanity, people of goodness, should pay homage, should pay tribute to his sacrifices, and make